I'm going to start this morning with a poem called The Subway Jesus. I'm late, a date. Thoughts wander as the car thunders by. I'm engulfed in the crowd, move forward and side. My feet search for footing. Mothers push aluminum strollers. Baby smiles, drooling. I'm in, grab my pack on my back, stand facing the deadpan crowd, sway to the time, to the clanking roll of the L train cross town. I get off quick, no time to lose, got to get to where I'm going, no time to lose. Walk swiftly to the A train, uptown, reach the platform, look round. No aggressive mothers here with their strollers of drool. Train's in sight, rat runs for cover. I watch and wonder as the train comes in sight, passing with a thunderous roar. Hair blows from hot air of the A train uptown. Get on. Next stop, a spot. I move with ease into the seat, looking and feeling like I'm on the soul train. My whiteness blinds the folks next to me with their rich mocha skin. I glow in the dark. I'll show you an easy trick you'll see. The A train's for me as it rattles and rolls uptown. I get bumped, drop my book, look down and swear, Jesus. Sit up, two eyes of watery reflective brown turn and stare into mine. What? He replies. What do you mean, what? I think. I swore, sorry, Jesus. What? Oh, Lord. Oh, man, oh, for the love of, there he was, sweet Jesus, there he was, sweet Jesus, on soulful A train uptown. His face calm and dark, sweet Jesus was no white man. Jesus, my man, was black, a man of patience and love, with soulful, piercing eyes staring into mine. His hair was short and spiral-topped, his demeanor calm, so calm in the clamor of the train. I began to lull, my breathing slowed. The clamor of the train resembles a stroller rocking back and forth, lulling me away on the A train uptown. Sweet Jesus, I whisper. What? He replies. I stumble for appropriate words. Jesus, the prophet of the ages, is on the train looking and listening to the ways of our age. He seems amiss and somewhat distraught. He watches and sways, bouncing and nodding in time to the train. What happened? He said. What? What happened? To what? To what? I wonder. What happened? He said. To my message. To my message of love and of giving. To my message of forgiving and learning. Did I say all this? What has become of my message? What has become of my message? I did not say the kingdom was far. I said the kingdom was here within, not in some heaven in the sweet by and by. What happened? He said. His eyes searched the car for answers. None came. You know that they said I would come back. I did, you see. I saw sweet Jesus was a man on the A train uptown. What happened? Don't know, I reply. Been confused myself, sweet Jesus, I reply. Why? Why, lots said, I reply. So I learned, he replied. Work for justice, he whispers. Work, and you shall find the kingdom within. Work and be righteous and in peace. Work and you shall find me. Be fair, be love, be kind. Work and you shall find the kingdom within. A train uptown, my stop, pause. Got to go, I'm late, a date. Work for justice, he whispers. Tell your message, I reply. Doors close, grab my pack on my back. Sweet Jesus is a black man on the A train uptown. I wrote that poem about 20 years ago after taking the subway home to my apartment in the Lower East Side of Manhattan, and with the resonant ruminations of my New Testament professor still ruminating in my own head. I went to a lefty Christian seminary, and this was what I was after with Jesus. I'd grown up Unitarian Universalist, and Jesus wasn't mentioned much. He'd occasionally wander forth to check if his shadow appeared around Christmas and Easter, but that was about it, really. In seminary, I learned his primary guiding force was to find the kingdom of God found within the heart. Stephen Mitchell, in his book, The Gospel According to Jesus, says it best. His teachings have such a deep moral resonance, and in this, he is prototypically Jewish. What is required of us is to do justice, to walk humbly with our God, and to love mercy. To really get at whom Jesus represents, I actually should have written the poem with Jesus not just black, but disabled, transgendered, illegitimate, old, and female. For this is what the crux of his message was about. He believed the least of these is the greatest of these. He saw himself as a full part of humanity, as connected to all people, as incapable of really escaping the tugs of that interdependent web. Everyone was his brother and sister, mother and father. Everyone was a part of him. When asked by a student once what the most kind of important commandment was, he said, basically, I'm going to call it a tie. To love your God with all your heart and to love your neighbor as yourself. So it was in seminary I came to know the real Jesus, not the Jesus wiped clean of any edge or fault or squirmish manners, not the white bread Jesus proclaiming to save my soul from the fiery dungeons of hell. But let me just say, my interest in Jesus grew, and I had a new appreciation for what his life was like. Then I married a real Jesus lover. Scott, my husband, grew up in the Anabaptist movement, think Amish with zippers. It's true. So anyway, they have central to kind of their understanding, their trinity within the Anabaptist movement is more humility, service, and peace. These are the historic peace churches, Church of the Brethren, Quakers, Mennonites, Amish. My husband went through an intensive course in high school to reflect and study, process, and register as a conscientious objector. Should be said that now Scott is a Unitarian Universalist minister with me. We've shared the position of senior minister at First Unitarian for the last 10 years, except this year he left to become a high mucky muck at the UUA. And I'm by myself. But I digress, really. Okay. So after being married to this atheist Jesus lover, I wanted to know why Jesus really was his main man, what he thought was so fabulous about it. And when I asked God, he has always told me to go check out these radical Mennonites. So I did. What I love about these folks is they don't really know if they dig Jesus that much, as he is not cuddly and soothing. They affirm that to live like Jesus, to act like Jesus, isn't an easy message to follow. Here's what one of them, Laurel Matheson, says. The more I read the Bible, the less I'm sure that Jesus loved me, or that he would be a nice person to have living in my heart, even if he wanted to be there. Jesus of Nazareth is not a sensitive New Age guy. Frankly, he seems a little erratic, wild-eyed, harshly truthful, often impatient. What interpretation of the Bible were the teddy bear Jesus-believing readers reading? At times, I wanted their version. But we do ourselves a disservice when we try to tame Jesus. If Jesus remains somewhat wild-eyed and mysterious in my reading and imaginations, it's not surprising. Would we expect to fully know and befriend God? The crazy things he says, like, love your enemies, is the reason I think the Spirit of the Lord was upon him at all. And in rubbing away his rough edges, his otherness, I risk rubbing away the Spirit of God. So I have come to think of Jesus, the one I revere, as the pre-Easter Jesus. There is no Son of God, no Christ, no heaven and hell determined on sin, no miracles, no walking on water. I have come to revere the Jesus that our Unitarian and our Universalist forebears believed in, Jesus of Nazareth. Which leads me to this rub. We are a tradition that grew out of Christianity. And yet, if you took a spectrum of Christianity and you had over here the fundamentalists on one side and you had something like the left kind of liberal congregationalists, we fell off the edge. We have. We aren't Christian. And we use Jesus as one of many spiritual advisors to help guide us in our living and loving. Our Jesus is an exemplar human, while conversely, in the end, just a regular Joe. Which gets me to Christmas. Been in the ministry now for almost 20 years. And at every congregation my husband and I have served at, the pews are packed at Christmas Eve. There are always people showing up yearning for kind of that magic to appear so they get yanked out of the craziness of the season and let the materialism and the consumerism and that buy word you have in your head through all of December. They want it just to go away for maybe an hour and be present on Christmas Eve. Now, for the first 10 years of our ministry, Scott and I wrestled with how best to celebrate Jesus. We didn't see people elated at the holiday season, rather burned out and frazzled and often feeling guilty about overspending. Many of them were hopeful that this gift might finally make their 8-year-old satiated for more than 10 minutes. Benny just yearned for a holiday family dinner that wasn't ruined with too much excess. Presents, alcohol, noise, consumerism, disappointment, expectation, and greed. For those first 10 years, we did our best to lift up Jesus at Christmas, which worked on one level, and on a whole other level, it didn't work. So with no, mainly because Christmas is about Jesus, it's about the Christ piece. It's about the Son of God being born. So with no Christ, where does that leave most of us? We felt for a long time we needed something deeper, more binding, more celebratory, that connection between people instead to one another's needs rather than separating them. We wanted to take back Christmas to honor the Jesus that we knew and loved. Further, we have always loved the lines of the theologian John Crossan. We've always kind of held this quote at the center of our ministry. He says this: as the people of the earth increasingly divide into two classes called rich and poor, the first step towards the kingdom is deciding whose side is God on. Then we must ask ourselves, how radical must we be? A church that does not answer this question is dealing not in religion but in hypocrisy. It's offering a transcendental Prozac, a little vacation, every Sunday. Rather than giving coins to beggars, we should change the church so that it makes the world a better place. So we set about changing the church to make the world a better place. Here's how. We started a project called The Greater Good. We asked our parishioners to look at their Christmas spending, everything from what you spent on a tree to your Christmas cards to the wrapping to extra kind of events you went to your presence, and take that number, add it all up, cut it in half. You save half for yourself, and you give the other half to the church for a project for the greater good. Then we had Jesus lead us. His story is about a child born in a barn, a child that is born into poverty, a child, actually, that is surrounded by poverty. So any project or organization we would give our money to had to deal with issues around poverty. We also focused on the child will lead us as well as the poverty part. A child will lead us is what the wise men foretold. So we decided to let the children in our church guide the way. Since children, in theory, actually have the most to lose at Christmas, they get to vote on the one or two organizations that would receive the money. We've used memorable slogans like, Christmas is not your birthday, it's Jesus' birthday. Though I do have two parishioners who their birthday is on Christmas, so it doesn't... Or we've used things like, live more simply, so others can simply live. So that first year, we didn't really know what to expect. At the time, we were a congregation about your size, about 700 people. And we had hope for 50,000, and I prayed in my own atheist way that we'd get 20,000. First year, we received $80,000. And we put that money to start a project in Honduras around clean water, and the other to a nonprofit in Rochester that worked with victims of violence. For 7 years, we have done this project around the Greater Good Offering, and we've given away now more than $450,000. Over the years, we've helped victims of human trafficking, farm workers, homeless youth, started a number of CSAs in inner city in Rochester, and this past year started a microfinancing bank for urban Rochester. The village in Honduras, which we originally partnered with the Department of Family Medicine at the University of Rochester, they have a global health initiative. They have been working with this village in Honduras for a number of years. Well, it turns out when they bring these docs down there twice a year, their main problem for years has been not simple things that a doctor can help with, but things like dysentery. Their water's so bad that they have children dying over time. So our first big push with them and where our money went was for cisterns and water filters. But then over the years, we've worked with them for 7 years. We've sent people down there, been a part of their delegations. They've also had cook stoves, latrines, and now school scholarships for kids over the age of sixth grade because school stops then. I have to say, I really couldn't be prouder of a project that made the holiday real for people. And it gave it depth and meaning. And it brought us together really to serve needs greater than our own, but also to see somebody else's needs as your own as well. So all of that is great. But for me, always, the piece that I've loved about this is how it has changed my own family. My daughter Solveig was 10 the second year that we did the Greater Good Project. Now I have to say that my kids, before this, used to have a limit of $50 for a Christmas present, and now I brought the Greater Good around, and they're like, $25 for a Greater Good? Come on, Mom. So I was a little worried about the pushback, and their friends, of course, are getting like new snowboards and $100 gift cards and new iPods. So I was, anxious about it, and we had talked a lot about it. But that year, Solveig says to me about 2 weeks before Christmas, she says, Mom, all I want for Christmas is that really good bread you get at the bakery, and I want that excellent cheese that you reserve for adults all the time, and I want my name on it, and I want it in the refrigerator. That's all I want. Okay, I said. That's a 10-year-old. Got it. It wasn't her birthday. It wasn't even about her. The season and our understanding of our religious obligation to serving needs greater than our own was embedded in my child. She was embodying Christmas. And I tell you, sometimes when I think back on that, I get all choked up. Like, that's the best gift I think I've ever gotten around the holiday season, which came from a kid who's an average American kid who's somewhat privileged and feels entitled at times. But what a great gift to get on a Thursday night. Roger has told me that you folks are considering maybe doing this project this next year. And all I can say to you is this. It will take sacrifice on your part. It will take a strong will to have to say no to people you love, who you want to say yes to. Some people may consider you stingy or punitive, or think that you are Ebenezer Scrooge's half-brother. I would never say doing this is easy. In fact, it will take considerable reframing with your immediate family, with relatives and coworkers and friends alike. It will take all of you scrounging around in your heart and pushing things aside and finding there is a lot more room in there for the stranger, the broken, the homeless, the lonely, the hungry, and the desperate to take a permanent stance in your cavity of pumping love, more so than you could ever imagine. It will also do this, though. It will change you. It will bring a new grounding to your life. And instead of feeling swept away by consumerism and materialism and selfishness and me-ism, our culture so readily expects us to participate in, you will feel connected to those you love and those you do not know because you have changed. You will see the human family and our obligation to one another in a whole new light. You, in fact, will be the change that you want to see in the world. It will bring a sense of wonder and gratitude to your children. They will know and care and participate in serving needs greater than their own, and it will make them larger in spirit, more generous in love, kinder in their actions. They will now understand on a very fundamental level, we are here to share. We just are. And it will bring you to your knees in gratitude for what you have. It will make you appreciate your family and your life and your house and your car and your dog and the view out the window in your kitchen. It will change you because you will actually become the person you most want to be in the world. Generous and grateful, satiated, awake, and connected will bring you back to life. My most fervent prayer for you is you take on the greater good as a gift to yourself. Yes, it saves and transforms and changes many people's lives. But perhaps most importantly, it changes you for good. And I can't think of a better gift to give yourself than that. May it be so.